This is Audible.
Belinda presents this unabridged recording of Picnic at Hanging Rock, written by Joan Lindsay and read by Yael Stone.
Cast of characters. Mrs. Appleyard, headmistress of Appleyard College. Miss Greta McCorrell, mathematics mistress. Mademoiselle Diane de Portiers, French and dancing mistress. Miss Dora Lumley, Miss Buck, junior mistresses. Miranda, Irma Leopold, Marion Quaid, senior boarders. Edith Horton, the college dance. Sarah Wayborn, the youngest boarder. Rosamond, Blanche, and the other boarders. Cook, Minnie and Alice, domestic staff at the college. Edward Whitehead, the college gardener. Irish Tom, handyman at the college. Mr. Ben Hussey, of Hussey's Livery Stables, Woodend. Dr. Mackenzie, a family doctor from Woodend. Constable Bumfer, of the Woodend Police Station. Mrs. Bumfer. Jim, a young policeman. Monsieur Louis Montpellier, the Bendigo watchmaker. Reg Lumley, brother of Dora Lumley. Jasper Cosgrove, guardian of Sarah Wayborn. Colonel and Mrs. Fitzhubert, summer residents at the Lakeview Upper Macedon. The Honourable Michael Fitzhubert, their nephew from England. Albert Crundle, coachman at Lakeview. Mr. Cutler, gardener at Lakeview. Mrs. Cutler. Major Sprack and his daughter, Angela. English visitors at Government College, Macedon. Dr. Cooling, from Lower Macedon. And many others who do not appear in this book. Whether Picnic at Hanging Rock is fact or fiction, my readers must decide for themselves. As the fateful picnic took place in the year 1900, and all the characters who appear in this book are long since dead, it hardly seems important. 1. Everyone agreed that the day was just right for the picnic to Hanging Rock. A shimmering, summery morning, warm and still, with cicadas shrilling all through the breakfast from the loquat trees outside the dining room windows, and bees murmuring above the pansies bordering the drive. Heavy-headed dahlias flamed and drooped in the immaculate flowerbeds. The well-trimmed lawns steamed under the mounting sun. Already the gardener was watering the hydrangeas, still shaded by the kitchen wing at the rear of the college. The boarders at Mrs. Appleyard's College for Young Ladies had been up and scanning the bright, unclouded sky since 6 o'clock, and were now fluttering about in their holiday muslins like a flock of excited butterflies. Not only was it a Saturday and the long-awaited occasion of the annual picnic, but St. Valentine's Day, traditionally celebrated on the 14th of February by the interchange of elaborate cards and favours. All were madly romantic and strictly anonymous, supposedly the silent tribute of lovesick admirers, although Mr. Whitehead, the elderly English gardener, and Tom, the Irish groom, were almost the only two males to be so much as smiled at during the term. The headmistress was probably the only person at the college who received no cards. It was well known that Mrs. Appleyard disapproved of St. Valentine and his ridiculous greetings that cluttered up the college mantelpieces right up to Easter and gave as much extra dusting to the maids as the annual prize-giving. And such mantelpieces! Two in the long drawing room of white marble, supported by pairs of caryatids as firm of bust as Madame herself, others of carved and tortured wood, embellished with 1,000 winking, tiddling mirrors. Appleyard College was already, in the year 1900, an architectural anachronism in the Australian bush, a hopeless misfit in time and place. The clumsy two-story mansion was one of those elaborate houses that sprang up all over Australia like exotic fungi following the finding of gold. Why this particular stretch of flat, sparsely wooded country, a few miles out of the village of Macedon, crouching at the foot of the mount, had been selected as a suitable building site, nobody will ever know. The insignificant creek that meandered in a series of shallow pools down the slope at the rear of the 10-acre property offered little inducement as a setting for an Italianate mansion, nor the occasional glimpses through a screen of stringy-barked eucalypts of the misty summit of Mount Macedon, rising up to the east on the opposite side of the road. However, built it was, and of solid castle-main stone, to withstand the ravages of time. The original owner, whose name is long ago forgotten, had only lived in it for a year or two before the huge, ugly house was standing empty and up for sale. The spacious grounds comprising vegetable and flower gardens, pig and poultry pens, orchard and tennis lawns were in wonderful order, thanks to Mr. Whitehead, the English gardener, still in charge. There were several vehicles in the handsome stone stables, all in excellent repair. The hideous Victorian furnishings were as good as new, with marble mantelpieces direct from Italy and thick, piled carpets from Axminster. The oil lamps on cedar staircase were held aloft by classical statues. There was a grand piano in the long drawing room, and even a square tower, reached by a narrow, circular staircase, from which the Union Jack could be hoisted on Queen Victoria's birthday. To Mrs. Appleyard, newly arrived from England, with a considerable nest egg and letters of introduction to some of the leading Australian families, the mansion, standing well back from the Bendigo Road behind a low stone wall, was immediately impressive. The brown pebble eyes, ever on the alert for a bargain, summed up the amazing place as ideal for a select and suitably expensive boarding school. Better still, a college for young ladies. To the delight of the Bendigo house agent who was showing her over the property, she had bought it then and there, lock, stock and barrel, including the gardener, with a reduction for cash down and moved in. Whether the headmistress of Appleyard College, as the local white elephant, was at once rechristened in gold lettering on a handsome board at the big iron gates, had any previous experience in the educational field, was never divulged. It was unnecessary. With her high-piled greying pompadour and ample bosom, as rigidly controlled and disciplined as her private ambitions, the cameo portrait of her late husband flat on her respectable chest, the stately stranger looked precisely what the parents expected of an English headmistress. And as looking the part is well known to be more than half the battle in any form of business enterprise, from Punch and Judy to floating alone on the stock exchange, the college, from the very first day, was a success. And by the end of the first year, showing a gratifying profit. All this was nearly 6 years before this chronicle begins. Saint Valentine is impartial in his favours, and not only the young and beautiful were kept busy opening their cards this morning. Miranda, as usual, had a drawer of her wardrobe filled with lace-trimmed pledges of affection, although baby Joni's homegrown cupid and row of pencilled kisses addressed from Queensland in her father's large, loving hand held pride of place on the marble mantelpiece. Edith Horton, plain as a frog, had smugly accounted for at least 11, and even little Miss Lumley had produced at the breakfast table a card with a bilious-looking dove bearing the inscription, "I adore thee ever." A statement presumably coming from the drab, unspeakable brother who had called on his sister last term. Who else, reasoned the budding girls, would adore the myopic junior governess, eternally garbed in brown serge and flat-heeled shoes? "He is fond of her," said Miranda, ever charitable. "I saw them kissing goodbye at the hall door." "But, darling Miranda, Reg Lumley is such a dreary creature," laughed Irma, characteristically shaking out her blue-black curls and idly wondering why the school straw hat was so unbecoming. Radiantly lovely at 17, the little heiress was without personal vanity or pride of possession. She loved people and things to be beautiful, and pinned a bunch of wildflowers into her coat with as much pleasure as a breathtaking diamond brooch. Sometimes, just to look at Miranda's calm oval face and straight corn-yellow hair gave her a sharp little stab of pleasure. Darling Miranda, now gazing dreamily out at the sunlit garden. "What a wonderful day. I can hardly wait to get into the country." "Listen to her, girls. Anyone would think that Appleyard College was in the Melbourne slums." "Forests," said Miranda, "with ferns and birds, like we have at home, and spiders," Marion said. "I only wish someone had sent me a map of Hanging Rock for a Valentine. I could have taken it to the picnic." Irma was forever being struck by the extraordinary notions of Marion Quaid, and wanted to know whoever wanted to look at maps at a picnic. "I do," Marion truthfully said. "I always like to know exactly where I am." Reputed to have mastered long division in the cradle, Marion Quaid had spent the greater part of her 17 years in the relentless pursuit of knowledge. Small wonder that with her thin, intelligent features, sensitive nose that appeared to always be on scent of something long-awaited and sought, and thin, swift legs, she had come to resemble a greyhound. The girls began discussing their Valentines. Somebody had the nerve to send Miss McCraw a card on squared paper, covered with little sums, said Rosamond. Actually, this card had been the inspired gesture of Irish Tom, egged on by Minnie, the housemaid, for a lark. The 45-year-old purveyor of higher mathematics to the senior girls had received it with dry approval, figures in the eyes of Greta McCaw being a good deal more acceptable than roses and forget-me-nots. The very sight of a sheet of paper dotted over with numerals gave her a secret joy, a sense of power, knowing how, with a stroke or two of a pencil, they could be sorted out, divided, multiplied, rearranged to miraculous new conclusions. Tom's Valentine, though he never knew it, was a success. His choice for Minnie was a bleeding heart, embedded in roses and obviously in the last stages of fatal disease. Minnie was enchanted, as was Mademoiselle with an old French print of a solitary rose. Thus, St. Valentine reminded the inmates of Appleyard College of the colour and variety of love. Mademoiselle de Portiers, who taught dancing and French conversation and attended to the boarders' wardrobes, was bustling about in a fever of delighted anticipation. Like her charges, she wore a simple muslin dress in which she contrived to look elegant by the addition of a wide ribbon belt and shady straw hat. Only a few years older than some of the senior boarders, she was equally enchanted at the prospect of escaping from the suffocating routine of the college for a whole long summer day, and ran here and there amongst the girls assembling for a final roll call on the front veranda. "Dépêchez-vous, mes enfants, dépêchez-vous!" "Tais-toi, Irma," chirped the light canary voice of Mademoiselle, for whom La Petite Irma could do no wrong. The girl's voluptuous little breasts, her dimples, full red lips, naughty black eyes, and glossy black ringlets were a continual source of aesthetic pleasure. Sometimes in the dingy schoolroom, the Frenchwoman, brought up amongst the great European galleries, would look up from her desk and see her against a background of cherries and pineapples, cherubs and golden flagons. surrounded by elegant young men in velvet and satins.
C'est toi, Emma. Miss McCaw vient de arrive.
A gaunt female figure in a puce-coloured pelisse was emerging from the outdoor dunny, an earth closet reached by a secluded path edged with begonias. The governess walked at her usual measured pace, uninhibited as royalty, and with an almost royal dignity. Nobody had ever seen her in a hurry, or without her steel-rimmed spectacles. Greta McCraw had undertaken to take on picnic duty today, assisted by Mademoiselle, purely as a matter of coincidence. A brilliant mathematician, far too brilliant for her poorly paid job at the college, she would have given a £5 note to have spent this precious holiday, no matter how fine, shut up in her room with that fascinating new treatise on calculus. A tall woman, with dry ochre skin and coarse graying hair perched like an untidy bird's nest on top of her head, she had remained oblivious to the vagaries of the Australian scene, despite a residence of 30 years. Climate meant nothing, nor fashion, nor the never-ending miles of gum trees and dry yellow grass, of which she was hardly more aware than of the mists and mountains of her native Scotland as a girl. The boarders, used to her outlandish wardrobe, were no longer amused, and her choice for today's picnic went without comment. The well-known church-going toque and black-laced boots, together with the puce-coloured pelisse, in which her bony frame took on the proportions of one of her Euclidean triangles, and a pair of rather shabby puce-kid gloves. Mademoiselle, on the other hand, as an admired arbiter of fashion, was minutely examined and passed, with honours, down to the turquoise ring and the white silk gloves. "Although," said Blanche, "I'm surprised at her letting Edith go out in those larky blue ribbons. Whatever is Edith looking at over there?" A pasty-faced 14-year-old with the contours of an overstuffed bolster was standing a few feet away, staring up at the window of a room on the first floor. Miranda tossed back her straight corn-coloured hair, smiling and waving at a pale little pointed face looking dejectedly down at the animated scene below.
"It's not fair," said Irma, waving and smiling too. "After all, the child is only 13. I never thought Mrs. A would be so mean."
Miranda sighed. Poor little Sarah, she wanted so much to go to the picnic. Failure to recite The Wreck of the Hesperus yesterday had condemned the child, Sarah Wayborn, to solitary confinement upstairs. Later she would pass the sweet summer afternoon in an empty schoolroom, committing the hated masterpiece to memory. The college was already, despite its brief existence, quite famed for its discipline, deportment, and mastery of English literature. Now an immense, purposeful figure was swimming and billowing in grey silk taffeta onto the tiled and colonnaded veranda like a galleon in full sail. On the gently heaving bosom, a cameo portrait of a gentleman in side whiskers, framed in garnets and gold, rose and fell in tune with the pumping of the powerful lungs encased in a fortress of steel busks and stiff grey calico.
"Good morning, girls," boomed the gracious plummy voice, especially imported from Kensington.
"Good morning, Mrs. Appleyard,"
chorused the curtsying half-circle drawn up before the hall door.
"Are we all present, Mademoiselle?" "Good. Well, young ladies, we are indeed fortunate in the weather for our picnic to Hanging Rock. I have instructed Mademoiselle that as the day is likely to be warm, you may remove your gloves after the drag has passed through Wood End. You will partake of luncheon at the picnic grounds near the rock. Once again, let me remind you that the rock itself is extremely dangerous, and you are therefore forbidden to engage in any tomboy foolishness in the matter of exploration, even on the lower slopes. It is, however, a geological marvel on which you will be required to write a brief essay on Monday morning. I also wish to remind you that the vicinity is renowned for its venomous snakes and poisonous ants of various species. I think that is all. Have a pleasant day, and try to behave yourself in a manner to bring credit to the college. I shall expect you back, Miss McCraw and Mademoiselle, at about 8 o'clock for a light supper.
The covered drag from Hussey's livery stables at Lower Macedon, drawn by 5 splendid bay horses, was already drawn up at the college gates, with Mr. Hussey on the box. Mr. Hussey had personally driven the college on all important occasions ever since the grand opening day, when the parents had come up by train from Melbourne to drink champagne on the lawns. With his kindly, shrewd blue eyes and cheeks perpetually blooming like the Mount Macedon Rose Garden, he was a prime favourite with everyone in the district. Even Mrs. Appleyard called him her good man and enjoyed graciously inviting him into her study for a glass of sherry.
"Steady there, sailor. Well, Duchess Belmonte, I'll give you such a lathering."
The 5 well-trained horses were actually standing like statues, but it was all part of the fun. Mr. Hussey, like all good coachmen, having a nice sense of style and timing.
"Mind your gloves on the wheel, Miss McCraw. It's dusty."
He had long ago given up attempting to teach this basic truth to lady passengers about to enter one of his cabs. At last, everyone was seated to the satisfaction of special friends and enemies and the 2 governesses. The 3 senior girls, Miranda, Irma, and Marion Quaid, inseparable companions, were allotted the coveted box seat in the front beside the driver, an arrangement with which Mr. Hussey was well pleased. Nice, high-spirited girls, all 3 of them.
"Thank you, Mr. Hussey. You may go now," Miss McCraw ordered somewhere from the rear, suddenly aware of non-mathematical responsibilities and in full command.
They were off, the college already out of sight, except for the tower through the trees, as they bowled along the level Melbourne-Bendigo Road, vibrating with particles of fine red dust.
"Get up, sailor, you lazy brute. Prince Belmonte, get back in your collars."
For the first mile or two, the scenery was familiar through the daily perambulation of the college crocodile. The passengers knew only too well, without bothering to look out, how the scraggy, stringy-bark forest lined the road on either side, now and then opening out onto a lighter patch of cleared land. The Compton's whitewashed cottage, whose sprawling quince trees supplied the college with jellies and jams, the clump of wayside willows at which the governess in charge would invariably call a halt and head for home. It was the same in Longman's High Roads of History, where the class were forever turning back for recapitulation at the death of King George IV before starting off again with Edward III next term. Now the willows in rich summer green were gaily past, and a sense of adventure ahead took over as heads began to peer through the buttoned tarpaulin flaps of the drag. The road took a slight turn. There was a fresher green amongst the dun-coloured foliage, and now and then a stand of blue-black pines, a glimpse of Mount Macedon, tufted as usual with fluffy white clouds above the southern slopes, where the romantic summer villas hinted at far-off adult delights. At Appleyard College, silence was golden, written up in corridors and often imposed. There was a delicious freedom about the swift, steady motion of the drag, and even in the warm, dusty air blowing up in their faces, that set the passengers chirping and chattering like budgerigars. On the box seat, the 3 senior girls perched beside Mr. Hussey were talking in blissful inconsequence of dreams, embroidery, warts, fireworks, and the coming Easter vacation. Mr. Hussey, who spent a large part of his working day in listening to miscellaneous conversation, kept his eyes on the road ahead and said nothing. "Mr. Hussey," said Miranda. Did you know today is St. Valentine's Day?
Well, Miss Miranda, I can't say I did. I don't know much about saints. What's this one's particular job?
Mamselle says he's the patron saint of lovers, Irma explained. He's a darling, sends people gorgeous cards with tinsel and real lace. Have a caramel?
Not while I'm driving, thanks all the same.
At last, Mr. Hussey had a conversational innings. He had been to the races last Saturday and seen a horse belonging to Irma's father come in first. What was the name of the horse and the distance? Marion Quade wanted to know. She wasn't specially interested in horses, but liked to store up snippets of useful information, like her late father, an eminent QC. Edith Horton, hating to be left out of anything and anxious to show off her ribbons, now leaned forward over Miranda's shoulder to ask why Mr. Hussey called his big brown horse Duchess. Mr. Hussey, who had his favourites amongst the passengers, was uncommunicative.
"Comes to that, miss, why are you called Edith?"
"Because Edith is my grandmother's name," she said primly. "Only horses don't have grandmothers like we do."
"Ah, don't they just?"
Mr. Hussey turned his square shoulders away from the silly child. The morning grew steadily hotter. The sun bore down on the shiny black roof of the drag, now covered with fine red dust that seeped through the loosely buttoned curtains into eyes and hair.
"And we do this for pleasure," Greta McCraw muttered from the shadows, "so that we may shortly be at the mercy of venomous snakes and poisonous ants. How foolish can human creatures be?"
Useless, too, to open the book in her satchel with all this schoolgirl chatter in one's ears. The road to Hanging Rock turned sharply away to the right, a little way out of the township of Wood End. Here, Mr. Hussey pulled up outside the leading hotel to rest and water his horses before starting on the last lap of the drive. Already the heat inside the vehicle was oppressive, and there was a wholesale peeling off of the obligatory gloves.
"Can't we take our hats off, too, Mamselle?" asked Irma, whose ink-black curls were floating out in a warm tide under the brim of her stiff school sailor.
Mademoiselle smiled and looked across at Miss McCraw, sitting opposite, awake and vertical, but with closed eyes, two puce kid hands locked together on her lap.
"Certainly not. Because we're on an excursion, there's no necessity to look like a wagon load of gypsies."
And re-entered the world of pure, uncluttered reason. The rhythmic beat of the horse's hooves, combined with the close air of the drag, was making them drowsy. As it was still only 11 o'clock, with plenty of time in which to reach the picnic grounds for lunch, the governesses conferred, and Mr. Hussey was requested to let down the steps of the drag at a suitable spot off the road. In the shade of an old white gum, the zinc-lined wicker basket that kept the milk and lemonade deliciously cool was taken out and unpacked. Hats were removed without further comment, and biscuits handed round.
"That's a long time since I tasted this stuff," said Mr. Hussey, sipping at his lemonade. "I don't take any hard liquor, though, when I've got a big day on my hands like this."
Miranda had risen to her feet, a mug of lemonade raised high above her head.
"To St. Valentine! St. Valentine!"
Everyone, including Mr. Hussey, raised their mugs and sent the lovely name ringing down the dusty road. Even Greta McCraw, who wouldn't have cared if they were drinking to Tom of Bedlam or the Shah of Persia, and was listening exclusively to the music of the spheres in her own head, absently raised an empty mug to her pale lips.
"And now," said Mr. Hussey, "if your saint has no objections, Miss Miranda, I think we'd better be on our way."
"Humans,"
Miss McCraw confided to a magpie picking up crumbs of shortbread at her feet, "are obsessed with the notion of perfectly useless movement. Nobody but an idiot ever seems to want to sit still for a change." And she climbed reluctantly back into her seat. The basket was repacked, the passengers counted in case anyone should be left behind, the steps of the drag pulled up under the floorboards, and once again they were on the road, moving through the scattered silvery shade of straight young trees, where the horses pressed forward through ripples of golden light that broke on straining shoulders and dark sweating rumps. The five sets of hooves were almost soundless on the soft, unmade surface of the country road. No traveller passed by. No birdsong splintered the sun-flecked silence. The grey-pointed leaves of the saplings hung lifeless in the noonday heat. The laughing, chattering girls in the warm, shadowed vehicle unconsciously fell silent until they were out again in full sunlight. "It must be nearly 12 o'clock," Mr. Hussey told his passengers, looking not at his watch but at the sun. "We haven't done too badly so far, ladies. I swore black and blue to your boss I'd have you back at the college by 8 o'clock."
The word college sent a chill into the warmth of the drag, and nobody answered.
For once, Greta McCraw must have been attending to general conversation, which she seldom did in the teacher's sitting room.
"There is no reason why we should be late, even if we linger for an extra hour at the rock. Mr. Hussey knows as well as I do that two sides of a triangle are together greater than the third. This morning we have driven along the two sides of a triangle. Am I correct, Mr. Hussey?"
The driver nodded in rather dazed agreement.
Miss McCraw was a queer fish, all right. "Very well. Then you only have to change your route this afternoon and return by the third side. In this case, since we entered this road at Woodend at right angles, the return journey will be along the hypotenuse."
This was really too much for Mr. Hussey's practical intelligence.
"I don't know about hippopotamuses, ma'am, but if you're thinking of the camel's hump..."
He pointed with his whip to the Macedon Ranges, where the hump stood out against the sky.
"It's a blooming sight longer road than the one we came by, arithmetic or not.
You might be interested to know there isn't even a made road, only sort of a rough track over the back of the mount."
"I was not referring to the camel's hump, Mr. Hussey. Thank you for your explanation, all the same. Knowing little of horses and roads, I tend to become theoretical. Marion, can you hear me up there up front? You understand what I mean, I hope?"
Marion Quaid, the only member of the class to take Pythagoras in her stride, was a favourite pupil, in the sense that a savage who understands a few words of the language of a shipwrecked sailor is a favourite savage. While they were talking, the angle of vision had gradually altered to bring the hanging rock into sudden, startling view. Directly ahead, the grey volcanic mass rose up, slabbed and pinnacled like a fortress from the empty yellow plain. The three girls on the box seat could see the vertical lines of the rocky walls, now and then gashed with indigo shade. Patches of grey-green dogwood, outcrops of boulders, even at this distance, immense and formidable. At the summit, apparently bare of living vegetation, a jagged line of rock cut across the serene blue of the sky. The driver was casually flicking at the amazing thing with his long-handled whip.
"There she is, ladies. Only about a mile and a half to go."
Mr. Hussey was full of comfortable facts and figures.
"Over 500 feet in height, volcanic, several monoliths, thousands of years old. Oh, pardon me, Miss McCraw, I should say millions. The mountain comes to Mohammed. The hanging rock comes to Mr. Hussey."
The very peculiar governess was smiling up at him, a secret, crooked smile that seemed to Mr. Hussey to have even less sense than the words. Mademoiselle, catching his eye, only just stopped herself from winking at the dear, bewildered man. Really, poor Greta was getting more eccentric every day. The drag turned sharply to the right, the pace quickened, and the voice of practical sanity boomed from the box seat.
I reckon you ladies will be wanting your lunches. I know I'll be ready for that chicken pie I've been hearing so much about.
The girls were all chattering again, and Edith was not the only one with thoughts centred on chicken pie. Heads craned out between the flaps for another sight of the rock, appearing and disappearing with every turn of the road. Sometimes close enough for the three girls in front to make out the two great balancing boulders near the summit, sometimes almost obscured by the foreground of shrub and tall forest trees. The so-called picnic grounds at the base of the Hanging Rock were entered through a sagging wooden gate, now closed. Miranda, an experienced gate opener on the family property at home, had climbed down, unasked, from the box seat and was expertly manipulating the warped wooden latch under the admiring eye of Mr. Hussey, who noted the sure touch of the slender hands, the dragging weight of the gate neatly supported on one hip. As soon as it was opened wide enough on its rusty hinges to allow safe passage of the drag, a flock of parrots flew out screeching from an overhanging tree, winging away across the sunlit grassy flats towards Mount Macedon, rising up all blue and green to the south.
Come up, sailor. Duchess, get over you. Belmonte, what do you think you're doing? Cripes, Miss Miranda, you'd think they'd never set eyes on a blooming parrot before.
So Mr. Hussey, in the best of holiday tempers, guided the five bay horses out of the known dependable present and into the unknown future, with the same happy confidence with which he daily negotiated the narrow gates of the Macedon livery stables in his own backyard. 2. Man-made improvements on nature at the picnic grounds consisted of several circles of flat stones to serve as fireplaces and a wooden privy in the shape of a Japanese pagoda. The creek, at the close of summer, ran sluggishly through long, dry grass, now and then almost disappearing to reappear as a shallow pool. Lunch had been set out on large white tablecloths close by, shaded from the heat of the sun by two or three spreading gums. In addition to the chicken pie, angel cakes, jellies, and the tepid bananas inseparable from an Australian picnic, Cook had provided a handsome iced cake in the shape of a heart, for which Tom had obligingly cut a mould from a piece of tin. Mr. Hussey had boiled up two immense billy cans of tea on a fire of bark and leaves, and was now enjoying a pipe in the shadow of the drag, where he could keep a watchful eye on his horses tethered in the shade. The only other occupants of the picnic grounds were a party of three or four people encamped some distance away, under some blackwoods on the opposite side of the creek, where a large bay horse and a white Arab pony were lunching from two chaff bags beside an open wagonette.
"How dreadfully quiet it is out here," observed Edith, helping herself lavishly to cream. "How can anyone prefer to live in the country? I can't imagine, unless, of course, they are dreadfully poor."
"If everyone else in Australia felt like that, you wouldn't be making yourself fat on rich cream," Marion pointed out.
"Except for those people over there with the wagonette, we might be the only living creatures in the whole world," said Edith, airily dismissing the entire animal kingdom at one stroke.
The sunny slopes and shadowed forests, to Edith, so still and silent, were actually teeming with unheard rustlings and twitterings, scufflings, scratchings, the light brush of unseen wings. Leaves, flowers and grasses glowed and trembled under the canopy of light. Cloud shadows gave way to golden motes dancing above the pool where water beetles skimmed and darted. On the rocks and grass, the diligent ants were crossing miniature saharas of dry sand, jungles of seeding grass in the never-ending task of collecting and storing food. Here, scattered about, amongst the mountainous human shapes, were heaven-sent crumbs, caraway seeds, a shred of crystallized ginger, strange, exotic, but recognizably edible loot. A battalion of sugar ants, almost bent in half with the effort, were laboriously dragging a piece of icing off the cake to some subterranean larder, dangerously situated within inches of Blanche's yellow head, pillowed on a rock. Lizards basked on the hottest stones. A lumbering armor-plated beetle rolled over in the dry leaves and lay helplessly kicking on its back. Fat white grubs and flat grey woodlice preferred the dank security of layers of rotting bark. Torpid snakes lay coiled in their secret holes, awaiting the twilight hour when they would come sliding from hollow logs to drink at the creek, while in the hidden depths of the shrub the birds waited for the heat of the day to pass. Insulated from the natural contacts with earth, air and sunlight, by corsets pressing on solar plexus, by voluminous petticoats, cotton stockings and kid boots, the drowsy, well-fed girls lounging in the shade were no more part of their environment than figures in a photograph album, arbitrarily posed against a back cloth of cork rocks and cardboard trees. Hunger satisfied, and the unwanted delicacies enjoyed to the last morsel, the cups and plates rinsed at the pool, they settled down to amuse themselves for the remainder of the afternoon. Some wandered off in twos and threes, under strict injunctions not to stray out of sight of the drag. Others, drugged with rich food and sunshine, dozed and dreamed. Rosamond produced some fancy work. Blanche was already asleep. Two industrious sisters from New Zealand were making pencil sketches of Miss McCraw, who had at last removed the kid gloves in which she had absently begun to eat a banana with disastrous results. Sitting upright on a fallen log, with her knife of a nose in a book and steel-rimmed spectacles, she was almost too easy to caricature. Beside her, Mademoiselle, her blonde hair falling about her face, was relaxed at full length on the grass. Irma had borrowed her mother-of-pearl penknife and was peeling a ripe apricot with a voluptuous delicacy worthy of Cleopatra's banquet. "Why is it, Miranda," she whispered, "that such a sweet, pretty creature is a schoolteacher of all dreary things in the world?" "Oh, here comes Mr. Hussey. It seems such a shame to wake her." "I am not asleep, ma petite, only daydreaming," said the governess, propping up her head on an elbow with a faraway smile. "What is it, Mr. Hussey?"
"I'm sorry to disturb you, miss, but I want to make sure we get away no later than 5. Sooner, if my horses are ready."
"Of course, whatever you say. I shall see that the young ladies are ready whenever you are. What time is it now?"
"I was just going to ask you, miss. My old ticker seems to have stopped dead at 12 o'clock. Today of all days in the whole bloomin' year."
It happened that Mademoiselle's little French clock was in Bendigo, being repaired.
"At Moussu Montpellier's, miss."
"I think that is the watchmaker's name."
"In Golden Square? Then if I may say so, you've done real well for yourself."
A faint, unmistakable blush belied the coolness of the French ladies.
"Indeed."
However, Mr. Hussey had got his teeth into Moussu Montpellier and seemed unable to let him go, shaking him up and down like a dog with a bone. "Let me tell you, miss, Moussu Montpellier and his father before him is one of the best men in his line, in Australia. And a fine gentleman, too. You couldn't have gone to a better man."
"So I understand. Miranda, you have your pretty little diamond watch. Can you tell us the time?"
"I'm sorry, mademoiselle, I don't wear it anymore. I can't stand to hear it ticking all day long just above my heart."
"If it were mine," said Irma, "I would never take it off, not even in the bath. Would you, Mr. Hussey?"
Jerked into reluctant action, Miss McCraw closed her book and sent a pair of bony fingers into the folds of the flat puce bosom and came out with an old-fashioned gold repeater on a chain.
Stopped 12. Never stopped before. My papa's.
Mr. Hussey was reduced to looking knowingly at the shadow of the hanging rock, which ever since luncheon had been creeping down towards the picnic grounds on the flat.
I shall put the billy on again for a cup of tea before we go. Say about an hour from now?
An hour, said Marion Quaid, producing some squared paper and a ruler.
I should like to make a few measurements at the base of the rock, if we have time.
As both Miranda and Irma wanted a closer view of the rock, they asked permission to take a walk as far as the lower slope before tea. It was granted after a moment's hesitation by Mademoiselle, Miss McCraw having disappeared again behind her book.
How far is it as the cock crows, Miranda?
Only a few hundred yards, said Marion Quaid. We shall have to walk along by the creek, which will take a little longer.
May I come too?
Asked Edith, rising to her feet with a prodigious show of yawning.
Oh, I ate so much pie at lunch, I can hardly keep awake.
The other two looked inquiringly at Miranda, and Edith was allowed to tag along behind.
Don't worry about us, Mademoiselle dear, smiled Miranda. We shall only be gone a very little while.
The governess stood and watched the four girls walking off towards the creek, Miranda a little ahead, gliding through tall grasses that brushed her pale skirts, Marion and Irma following arm in arm, with Edith bumbling along in the rear. When they reached the clump of rushes where the stream changed its course, Miranda stopped, turned her shining head, and gravely smiled at Mademoiselle, who smiled back and waved, and stood there smiling and waving until they were out of sight round the bend.
Mon Dieu, she exclaimed to the empty blue. Now I know.
What do you know?
Asked Greta McCraw, suddenly peering up over the top of her book, alert and factual, as was her disconcerting way. The Frenchwoman, seldom at a loss for a word, even in English, found herself embarrassingly tongue-tied. It simply wasn't possible to explain to Miss McCraw, of all people, her exciting discovery that Miranda was a Botticelli angel from the Uffizi. Impossible to explain, or even think clearly on a summer afternoon, of things that really mattered. Love, for instance, when only a few minutes ago the thought of Louis's hand expertly turning the key of the little Sèvres clock had made her feel almost ready to faint. She lay down again on the warm scented grass, watching the shadows of overhanging branches moving away from the hamper containing milk and lemonade. Soon it would be exposed to the full glare of the sun, and she must rouse herself and carry it into the shade. Already the four girls must have been away for 10 minutes, perhaps more. It was unnecessary to consult a watch. The exquisite languor of the afternoon told her that this was the hour when people weary of humdrum activities tend to doze and dream, as she was doing now. At Abelyard College, the pupils in the late afternoon classes had to be continually reminded to sit up straight and to get on with their lessons. Opening one eye, she could see the two industrious sisters at the pool had put away their sketchbooks and fallen asleep. Rosamond nodded over her embroidery. By a sheer effort of will, Mademoiselle made herself count over the 19 girls under her care. All except Edith and the three seniors were visible and within easy call. Closing her eyes, she permitted herself the luxury of continuing an interrupted dream. Meanwhile, the four girls were still following the winding course of the creek upstream. From its hidden source, somewhere in the tangle of bracken and dogwood at the base of the rock, it approached the level plain of the picnic ground as an almost invisible trickle, then suddenly, for 100 yards or so, became deeper and clearer. running quite swiftly over the smooth stones and presently opening out into a little pool ringed by grass of a brilliant watery green, which no doubt had made this particular spot the choice of the party with the wagonette for their picnic. A stout, bewhiskered elderly man with the solar topee tipped over a large scarlet face was lying fast asleep on his back, with his hands crossed over a stomach swathed in a scarlet cummerbund. Nearby, a little woman in an elaborate silk dress sat with closed eyes propped against a tree and a pile of cushions from the wagonette, fanning herself with a palm leaf fan. A slender fair youth, or very young man, in English riding breeches was absorbed in a magazine, while another, of about the same age or a little older, as tough and sunburnt as the other was tender and pink of cheek, was engaged in rinsing the champagne glasses at the edge of the pool. His coachman's cap and dark blue jacket with silver buttons were thrown carelessly over a clump of reeds, exposing a mop of thick, dark hair and a pair of strong, copper-coloured arms, heavily tattooed with mermaids. Although the four girls following the endless loops and turns of the Wayward Creek were now almost abreast of the picnic party, the Hanging Rock remained tantalizingly hidden behind a screen of tall forest trees. "We really must find a suitable place to cross over," said Miranda, screwing up her eyes. "Or we shall see nothing at all before we have to turn back." The creek was getting wider as it approached the pool. Marion Quade produced her ruler. "At least 4 feet and no stepping stones." "I vote we take a flying leap and hope for the best," said Irma, gathering up her skirts. "Can you manage it, Edith?" Miranda asked. "I don't know. I don't want to wet my feet." "Why not?" asked Marion Quade. "I might get pneumonia and die, and then you'd stop teasing me and be sorry." The bright, fast-flowing water was crossed without mishap, to the obvious approval of the young coachman who had greeted their approach with a low, penetrating whistle. As soon as the girls were out of earshot and walking away towards the southern slopes of the rock, the youth in the riding breeches threw down the Illustrated London News and strolled down towards the pool.
"Can I lend you a hand with those glasses?"
"No, you can't. I'm only giving him a bit of a lick over so Cook won't rouse on me when I get home."
"Oh, I see. I'm afraid I don't know much about washing up. Look here, Albert, I hope you won't mind my saying so, but I wish you hadn't done that just now."
"Done what, Mr. Michael?"
"Whistled at those girls when they were going to jump over the creek."
"It's a free country as far as I know. What's the harm in a whistle?"
"Only that you're such a good chap," said the other. "And nice girls don't like being whistled at by fellows they don't know."
Albert grinned. "Don't you believe it. The Sheilas is all alike when it comes to the fellows. Do you reckon they come from Appleyard College?"
"Dash it all, Albert. I've only been in Australia a few weeks. How should I know who they are? As a matter of fact, I only saw them for a moment when I heard you whistle and looked up."
"Well, you can take my word for it," Albert said, "and I've knocked around a fair bit. It's all the same if it's a bloody college they come from or the Ballarat orphanage where me and my kid sister was dragged up."
Michael said slowly, "I'm sorry. I didn't know you were an orphan."
"As good as. After me mum cleared out with the bloke from Sydney and me dad walked out on the two of us, that's when we was clapped into the bloody orphanage."
"An orphanage," repeated the other, who felt himself listening to a first-hand account of life on Devil's Island. "Tell me, if you don't mind talking about it, what's it like to be brought up in one of those places?"
"Lousy." Albert had finished the glasses and was neatly putting away the Colonel's silver mugs in their leather case.
"Lord, how revolting."
"Oh, it was clean enough in its way.
No lice or anything except when some poor little bugger of a kid gets sent there with nits in its head and Matron gets out a bloody great scissors and cuts off its hair.
Michael appeared fascinated by the subject of the orphanage.
Go on, tell me some more about it. Did they let you see much of your sister?
Well, you see, there was bars on all the windows in my day. Boys in one classroom, girls in the other.
Geez, I haven't thought about that bloody dump for donkey's years.
Don't talk so loud. If my aunt hears you swearing, she'll try and make Uncle give you the sack.
Not him, said the other, grinning. The Colonel knows I look after his horses damn well and I don't drink his whiskey. Well, hardly ever. To tell you the truth, I can't stand the stink of the stuff. This here French fizz of your uncle's will do me. Nice and light in the stomach.
Albert's worldly wisdom was unending. Michael was filled with admiration. I say, Albert, I wish you'd cut out that Mr. Michael stuff. It doesn't sound like Australia, and anyway, my name's Mike to you, unless my aunt's listening.
Have it your own way. Mike? Is that short for the Honourable Michael Fitzhubert, what's on your letters?
Geez, what a mouthful. I wouldn't recognise mine if I was to see it written down in print. To the English youth whose own ancient name was a valued personal possession that travelled everywhere with him, like his pigskin valise and well-filled notecase, this somewhat startling observation needed several minutes of silence to digest, while the coachman surprisingly went on.
My dad used to change his name now and then when he got in a tight corner. I forget what they signed us up at the orphanage. Not that I bloody well care. As far as I'm concerned, one bloody name's the same as the other.
I like talking to you, Albert. Somehow you always get me thinking.
Thinking's all right if you have the time for it, replied the other, reaching for his jacket. I'd better be harnessing up old Glory or your auntie's fur will be flying. She wants to get off early.
Righto. I'll just stretch my legs a bit before we go. Albert stood, looking after the slim boyish figure gracefully clearing the creek and striding off towards the rock.
Stretch his legs, is it? I don't mind betting he wants another look at them Sheilas. That little beaut with the black curls.
He went back to his horses and began stacking the cups and plates into the Indian straw basket. The four girls were already out of sight when Mike came out of the first belt of trees. He looked up at the vertical face of the rock and wondered how far they would go before turning back. The Hanging Rock, according to Albert, was a tough proposition even for experienced climbers. If Albert was right, and they were only schoolgirls about the same age as his sisters in England, how was it they were allowed to set out alone at the end of a summer afternoon? He reminded himself that he was in Australia now. Australia, where anything might happen. In England, everything had been done before, quite often by one's own ancestors, over and over again. He sat down on a fallen log, heard Albert calling him through the trees, and knew that this was the country where he, Michael Fitzhubert, was going to live. What was her name? The tall, pale girl with the straight yellow hair, who had gone skimming over the water like one of the white swans on his uncle's lake. 3. The creek had hardly been crossed before the Hanging Rock had risen up directly ahead of the four girls, clearly visible beyond a short, grassy slope. Miranda had been the first to see it.
No, no, Edith, not down at your boots, away up there, in the sky.
Mike remembered afterwards how she had stopped and called back over her shoulder to the little fat one trudging behind. The immediate impact of its soaring peaks induced a silence so impregnated with its powerful presence that even Edith was struck dumb. The splendid spectacle, as if by special arrangement between heaven and the headmistress of Appleyard College, was brilliantly illuminated for their inspection. On the steep southern facade, The play of golden light and deep violet shade revealed the intricate construction of long vertical slabs, some smooth as giant tombstones, others grooved and fluted by prehistoric architecture of wind and water, ice and fire. Huge boulders, originally spewed red-hot from the boiling bowels of the earth, now come to rest, cooled and rounded.